ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, as the deadly fire in Hong Kong continues to burn, hundreds of people are still missing. Also, the federal government secures a deal with the Greens to pass its environment protection laws, and Barnaby makes it official. He's quitting the Nationals, but will he join One Nation?
I think he's going to keep us guessing for a while. Is there a possibility he could be elected for One Nation in the Senate in New South Wales? Almost certainly.
First this evening to Hong Kong, where at least 44 people have died and more than 270 are missing after a massive fire engulfed several apartment buildings in the Tai Po district. Police believe gross negligence on the part of a construction company is to blame for the blaze's rapid spread. Three men have been arrested and could face charges of manslaughter. The fire is still burning. Tanya Dendrinos prepared this report.
It's been 24 hours and smoke is still eerily rising from a series of residential blocks in Hong Kong. Fire hoses spray the smouldering buildings. The rescue operation continues as bodies are recovered. Devastated residents look on in disbelief. Derek Armstrong Chan is the Deputy Director of Fire Services Operations.
The temperature inside the fire scene is still very high. So we have difficulties in proceeding to upper floors of two of the buildings.
The complex consists of eight 31-storey tower blocks. Seven have been impacted by the inferno. Some residents who evacuated the towers took shelter in a nearby community centre. My wife is still in the flat, explains Lawrence Lee. He was asked whether she'd tried to escape.
Yes, she tried. When the fire started, I told her on the phone to escape. But once she left the flat, the corridor and stairs were all filled with smoke and it was all so dark. So she had no choice but to go back to the flat.
The fire was classified a level 5 blaze, the most severe rating in Hong Kong. It's the worst the country has seen in decades. Eileen Chung is a senior superintendent with the Hong Kong Police Force.
During firefighting and rescue operations, the Fire Services Department discovered that the building's exterior walls had protective nets, membranes, waterproof tarpaulins, and plastic sheets suspected of not meeting fire safety standards. Meanwhile, our police investigation at the scene found that in an unaffected building, every floor's elevator lobby windows were sealed with foam material.
Authorities say the flammable materials may have acted as accelerants.
We do not rule out the possibility that these foam materials contributed to the rapid spread of the fire. According to preliminary police investigations, the foam was installed by a construction company carrying out maintenance work on the building. We have reason to believe that the company's responsible parties were grossly negligent, which led to this accident and caused the fire to spread uncontrollably, resulting in major casualties.
Police arrested three men aged between 52 and 68 on suspicion of manslaughter. Two were directors of a construction company, the other an engineering consultant. Experts have also raised concerns over the use of bamboo scaffolding. Chinese President Xi Jinping extended his condolences to those affected, as did Hong Kong's chief executive John Lee, who stressed the incident is being treated with the utmost seriousness. Multiple companies have already pledged millions of dollars to assist with the recovery effort.
Tanya Dendrinos. ABC correspondent Alison Horne has more for us on the situation in Hong Kong.
Well, it seems, according to authorities, that the majority of the blazes have been brought under control. So attention really now turns to those hundreds of people who are still missing. We've been watching a live kind of recording of those people that are missing. Their families have been registering them online, and you can see they're adding information. For example, I've got a 30-year-old sister who is in this apartment. Please go find her. So all this information is coming out online about these people who have been trapped inside these buildings. But the problem at the moment is authorities can't actually get inside. There are questions around the structural integrity of the buildings, and it's not a small task. We're talking about 7 of these 31, 32-storey residential apartment blocks that have been near completely destroyed. So it's going to be a harrowing afternoon, a long night, and this is going to continue into tomorrow. And people are lining the streets around the area, concerned about their loved ones, whether or not they've been trapped inside or have just gone elsewhere, and really trying to get any information as to what's happened to these hundreds of people.
Is there any sign that China is going to send more help from the mainland to help in this recovery and rescue operation?
So Hong Kong says that it hasn't officially requested any outside assistance. We have seen massive numbers of personnel that have been on the ground there, 800 or so firefighters, more than 100 ambulances, and also volunteers in bringing in food and offering their assistance to house people. We're seeing lots of offers of people saying, if you need products for your babies, if you need nappies or formula, or you need a cot, or you just need somewhere to stay, or you need somewhere to house your pets, bring them here to our place. We'll take care of you. So it does seem that people are really banding together throughout that community. But you have to imagine that this is not going to be a quick process in trying to go through those buildings and identify any of those people that have been trapped inside as well.
Yeah, it's a terrible situation. Alison, are the authorities there saying much more about how they think the fire started?
Well, the focus of their investigations are around this construction company that has been doing renovations on this complex for the last year or so. You would have seen in those pictures that we've been seeing from TV, the bamboo scaffolding wrapped around these buildings, and also this netting, the green netting that's put up to stop debris falling down. Authorities are saying that they believe that the company has been grossly negligent in its operations. They haven't really given any more information on that front, apart from confirming that 3 senior managers from that construction company have been arrested. I will also say, Sam, I've been speaking with residents who fled from the compound or weren't there at the time and have lost everything in their homes. And they have told me that for several months they have been registering complaints with the construction company that workers were smoking inside the bamboo scaffolding. So we're still trying to investigate that matter more, but undoubtedly this will all take shape of the investigation.
That's ABC correspondent Alison Horn. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. After a concerted push this week, the federal government has reached a deal with the Greens to pass laws reforming the nation's environment laws. It needed the support of that minor party or the coalition to get the legislation through. To get the Greens over the line, the Environment Minister made concessions to further protect native forests and bushland and ensure fossil fuel projects don't get fast-track approval. The 11th-hour deal was made on the final sitting day of the parliamentary year. Rachel Mealy has more.
The Prime Minister believes the bill gets the balance just right.
This is a win for business, it's a win for the environment,
the member for
and
Barker.
It's a win for the country.
Yeah. Australia's environmental laws haven't been updated for 25 years.
The current laws aren't just obsolete, they're an obstacle. And in 2000, the median approval time for a project was 48 weeks. Today, it's 118 weeks. That means investors walk away and costs rise.
The new bill amends the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act and will see the creation of a National Environment Protection Agency with powers to stop any development that's harmful to the environment. As well, it introduces national environmental standards and allows for fines of up to $825 million for anyone found breaching the laws. After scuppering a similar deal last year, the Prime Minister is happy to have met this year's deadline.
This is a government that is focused on delivery. We said we would deliver this legislation this year, and we have today in the Senate. We'll pass this legislation through the Senate. We'll receive it back here this afternoon and get this reform done. Yeah.
The opposition leader, Susan Lee, was the Environment Minister under the Morrison government. She says the deal will result in higher energy prices for Australians.
The government talked a big game about supply, a big game about unlocking critical projects for the future of this country. Well, today they have shut all of that down. Shame on them.
Under the changes, regional forestry agreements in New South Wales and Tasmania and high-risk agricultural land clearing will be brought under the Act from July 2027. The National Farmers Federation says it's bitterly disappointed by this aspect of the deal. Warwick Ragg says it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of agricultural practices.
The closer controls on high-risk land clearing probably mean that farmers will have to go through additional compliance mechanisms if they are likely to be where there are matters of national environmental significance. So we'll need some detail about how we're going to do this. Land clearing is a province of the states, so we'll need to understand how the Commonwealth is going to work with the states to introduce and implement these processes.
Glenn Walker is the head of the Nature Program at Greenpeace Australia Pacific.
This agreement is a significant step forward for our forests and nature in Australia. It finally gives the federal government powers to control rampant deforestation in this country and puts new rules and standards in place for how major projects are approved. Where it does fall short is it doesn't address the severe climate harm on nature from approving coal and gas projects. And so this is an area we'll continue to hold this government account for and we'll be seeking action on.
The Business Council of Australia's Chief Executive, Brian Black, says there's more work to be done.
What we need to do now, and I really do stress this point, our focus has got to be on state accreditation to administer the federal scheme. That is so important. That is the one point that I hope everybody takes away from today. That is where we get productivity gains, because that's how we can go about extracting one layer of assessments from what is clearly a broken and convoluted system.
On the same day a deal on the bill was struck, the Climate Change Authority has revealed that Australia is projected to fall just shy of its 2030 climate target and badly miss its 2035 target unless significant changes are made. Nicola Rivers is an environmental lawyer and the chief executive of Environmental Justice Australia.
This was a very important opportunity for the Albanese government to properly include climate into this legislation, and they have not done that. So it's a huge failure, and it will mean that it will be harder for Australia to meet its emission reduction targets in the future. This act could be a really good tool to help address our climate emissions, and now it won't. So, yeah, it's a huge failure there.
But she says closing the loopholes in relation to logging will have a lasting positive impact for the environment.
Ending those RFA, as they're known, those RFA exemptions is absolutely critical and will mean that when logging has a significant impact on threatened species, they have to get assessed for their impacts and hopefully, you know, minimised and reduced. So that's going to be a really important step forward.
Nicola Rivers from Environmental Justice Australia. That report from Rachel Mealy and Kathleen O'Connor. After a 20-year parliamentary career, the Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce is leaving the party and will sit as an independent for the rest of his term. Representing the New South Wales seat of New England, Mr Joyce was elected leader of the Nationals in 2016, making him the Deputy Prime Minister. But he had to resign a couple of years later when it was revealed he was having an affair with one of his staffers, whom he later married. Barnaby Joyce announced his resignation from the Nats in Parliament this afternoon.
I suppose the last change, when they talk about generational change, it's pretty clear what people want. One of the biggest things, though, Madam Deputy Speaker, is that after 5 weeks, I announced this about 5 weeks ago, apart from a 90-second phone conversation with the Leader, I've had no communication with either the Leader of the National Party or the Deputy Leader of the National Party to try and resolve this, and that's disappointing. So after 30 years with the National Party, I'm resigning from the party. And that really leaves me with a heavy heart. And I apologise for all the hurt that will cause other people. I really do.
For more on Barnaby Joyce's resignation from the Nationals and his future, I spoke to James Masola, who's the chief political commentator for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, and I asked him if the party's leader, David Littleproud, and other Nationals will be pleased to see Mr Joyce go.
Littleproud does command a fairly solid majority of Nationals MPs, and that means, following on from that, that probably there are a fair few Nationals MPs who've factored in this exit a while ago, made their peace with it, and almost thought, as one of them said to me the other day, all right, look, get on with it, Barnaby. Can you stop making this about yourself? You know, there's the exit. Walk through it. There's no doubt that there's some bad blood between Barnaby and the Nationals party room more broadly, and particularly that there's been bad blood between Littleproud and Joyce for quite some time.
Do you think Barnaby Joyce will join One Nation?
I think he's going to keep us guessing for a while, but I think almost inevitably that is going to happen. I think he would probably struggle to hold his seat of New England as a One Nation candidate. That's why, in part, he said this will be his last term. But I think, is there a possibility he could be elected for One Nation in the Senate in New South Wales? Almost certainly. As much as he turns a lot of inner city or metropolitan voters off, he has huge name recognition, and I think he'd romp it in. And from there, he's 58 at the moment. I think Senator Hanson's 71. You know, in 2 years' time, she'll be 73 and 60. You know, an orderly handover at some point in time in the future would be likely.
But that Senate election wouldn't be until 2028, would it? So if Mr Joyce is going to sit out the rest of his term in the lower house as the member for New England, why would he rush to announce a move to One Nation?
Well, we've gotten to this point in part because the news of a potential defection leaked out sooner. I think in part because of the deep frustration Joyce felt about, you know, being sent to the backbench and effectively told, you know, your career in the Nationals as a frontbencher is done. And I think partly it was driven by the angst over support for net zero. Now, Joyce was instrumental, one of the leading proponents in the coalition dropping support for net zero. He got what he wanted. But the manner in which they arrived at the decision and the way in which that played out in the Nationals in particular, I think, has angered Joyce. And so he said, you know what? I'm done.
Do you think he would be in a better position to fight for rural Australians, as he says he wants to, in One Nation?
No, I don't think he will be able to, but I think there will be some advantages for him in the Senate. So at the moment, he's, you know, way out on the back bench. He has no prospect of returning to the front bench while David Littleproud is leader of the party, and he looks like he will be for some time. I think Joyce's belief is that by stepping back into the Senate, and don't forget he's been there previously, he knows how the red chamber works, he will be able to potentially, hopefully in his view, wrangle Senate votes so that One Nation becomes a more consequential balance of power party. Now, Matt Canavan has already flagged that as a line of attack on One Nation. You know, what bridges have you delivered for people from the regions? What new roads, what new lighting have you delivered? The Nationals do that, One Nation doesn't. I think Barnaby Joyce is canny, and his play will be to transform the party, to take it into that next step where it can negotiate as a balance of power Senate party, coming from the centre-right, much as the Greens come from the centre-left.
Other news from Parliament House today, the government did succeed in getting a deal to get its environmental laws passed, and it reached that agreement with the Greens rather than the Coalition. What's your assessment of how all those sides of politics end up at the end of this parliamentary sitting year, James?
Look, I mean, this is a win for the government, obviously. They probably would have preferred to do a deal with Susan Lee and the opposition, but it was kind of a stop-start pattern, if you like, to those negotiations. They never really got off the ground. So they've done the deal with the Greens. I think the environmental watchdog agency that's going to be created, that's a good thing. I think, you know, Labor obviously had to give some ground to the Greens to allow native forest laws, to sort of apply nationally to expand from mid-2027. I think the government's plea is that there'll be fast tracking of at least some major projects, including renewable energy and housing. And look, I think, you know, there's some concerns from business that we've already heard, but I don't think these laws are too extreme or too out there, or they're going to cause the forestry logging industry to collapse immediately, for example. That's not the intention here. I think they've struck a fairly reasonable middle ground with the Greens.
So as the government pushes its environmental credentials, it's been confirmed today that it won't reach its emissions reduction targets for 2030 and 2035. How damaging is that for the Albanese government?
Look, despite Chris Bowen's kind of heroic assertions that Australia's on track for the last 12 months at least, I'd say, to hit those targets, this is not a surprise. And essentially it comes down to this. Can the government get the rollout of these electricity renewables projects in particular? Can it get that rollout sped up to meet those targets? That will, particularly for the 2030 target, make or break, or it will decide whether we get there.
James Masola is the chief political commentator for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The peak body for Australia's fire and emergency services is warning some parts of the country will be in, quote, a highly flammable state by January as the effects of a long dry spell and warm summer take hold. In its seasonal bushfire outlook released today, the Australasian Fire Authorities Council warned parts of southern WA, central New South Wales and large parts of Victoria will have an increased fire risk in January and February. Tyne Logan reports.
Summer in southern Australia always brings the risk of bushfire, and it's the Australian Council for Fire and Emergency Services' job to predict where that risk will be highest. Rob Webb is the chief executive.
Across Australia, there's a few areas that we're particularly watching, parts of Western Australia through into southern parts, central and southwestern parts in Victoria, and into the central and northwestern parts of New South Wales, particularly as we start to see the heat of summer come in and we get those days well above 35 to 40 degrees. It's not going to take much time for the fuels to dry out.
The risk in those areas is higher this season, in part because of severe dryness over a long period and predictions of a warmer than average summer. South Australia is not on that list because, despite suffering from 2 years of drought, recent rainfall has been enough to ease the risk. Victoria hasn't been so lucky. While rain has fallen and some greenery has emerged, it isn't enough to offset the long-term dry conditions. Rob Webb says it's created a dangerous illusion of safety.
Because of this deeper drying, it just means that any of the surface green that we've got will dry out. Victorians are talking about the mid-level fuels across the forest. There's a fair bit of dead fuel there. So as soon as you get 3 or 4 days in a row at 40 degrees and you find that everything starts to wilt, that green quickly disappears.
With the impact of drought still lingering, Victorian authorities have moved to prepare the worst affected areas ahead of the season. Jason Heffernan is the Victorian Country Fire Authority's chief officer.
This year, because of the drought conditions and because of the lack of availability of surface water, I made application to the government and thankfully they've provided me with $10 million this summer to put strategic bulk water across the state for this summer, ensuring that we've got more water available to our firefighters and communities when fires break out. Because the last thing I want to be doing right now is taking what little water there is in dams, in critical water supplies, when fires occur.
In Western Australia, southern areas are also facing increased risk, particularly in the grain-growing regions around Esperance on the south coast. Phil Longmire is a farmer, as well as Chief Bushfire Control Officer for the Esperance Shire.
The concern is that we have a reasonable stubble loading compared to last year. Crops are yielding better than expected across the district. So in reflection of that, we'll have pretty high fuel loads. We're lucky we've got a really strong volunteer base.
He says the region is already on high alert because it's had a string of smaller fires during harvest.
We've already had one that started from a header fire and ended up in the bushland, and that was probably our biggest fire for the year, and that was about 20,000 hectares. I'd say the risk is probably diminishes as we move through harvest and the district is probably running at about 50%.
In New South Wales, areas around Dubbo in the state's central west are also on high alert, having earlier this week seen the first catastrophic fire danger levels since 2023. Ben Millington is Deputy Commissioner of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service.
Whilst the central west is at higher risk, we've got a lot of grassland growth, a lot of forest fuel growth out in those parts of the state. People need to be prepared that we will see fires over the summer period and into the new year, and the time to prepare is now.
All of this will be occurring on what is a largely unclear rainfall outlook. A La Nina weather pattern is underway, but senior meteorologist at the Bureau of Meteorology, Dr. Simon Granger, says it's being overpowered.
Although there is a La Nina underway in the tropical Pacific, it's weak, it's likely to be short-lived, and our rainfall forecast is currently suggesting it's not the dominant influence on rainfall this summer.
The Bureau is forecasting hotter than average temperatures across almost the entire country this summer.
That report from Tyne Logan and Luke Radford. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For many years, he was considered a pariah on the world stage, but Donald Trump has now brought the Saudi Crown Prince back into the fold. We know the US president wants to do business with the wealthy Gulf state, but what else is he hoping to get out of it? Today, New York Times contributor Noah Shachman on how Donald Trump wants America to be a lot more like Saudi Arabia. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.